Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and you find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find more about us and the research that we do by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. As always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. In the previous episode, we explored who Lyle and Eric Menendez were, who their parents, Jose and Kitty, were. We heard how, at face value, it seems that the Menendez family had it all. But below every white picket fence crawls earthworms and centipedes, just like everywhere else. On August the 20th, 1989, Jose and Kitty were savagely gunned down in a cold-blooded and horrific attack which left them both mutilated and submerged in pools of their own blood. Initially, the brothers, who claimed to be out at the cinema at the time of the murders, blamed the murders on a mafia hit. But police were quick to dismiss this due to the modus operandi. It wouldn't take long for the police to set their sights on Eric and Lyle themselves, suspecting them of being the real killers. All they had to do was lay low and cooperate with law enforcement. Instead, after inheriting their parents' $14 million fortune, the boys went shopping and had a hell of a time doing it. Police were certain of who the killers were. They just needed the evidence. Then along came Judeline Smith, a woman who was having an affair with Eric's psychiatrist. She recorded Eric and Lyle's confessions to their shrink and shopped them to the police. The game was up for the Menendez brothers. But there was so much more to come. If you haven't listened to episode 1 in this 2-part series, please go back and check that out before heading into this second part. Why not listen to them both back to back? Now that's a hell of a good time. Anyway, on with the show. Eric and Lyle were formally indicted in December 1990. The boys cracked smiles and smirk as they were formally charged with first-degree murder. These faces alone decided the nation. Some wanted to adopt them, but others wanted to hang them. The circus had begun. Both brothers pleaded not guilty. As it turns out, they had been amused when the judge said Joe Say instead of Jose, and here started their unshakable public image of being spoiled rich kids with zero remorse. The first trial began on July 20th, 1993, at Van Nuys Superior Courthouse and was presided over by Judge Stanley Weisberg. Pamela Mazanik was assigned as lead prosecutor. She immediately argued that the murders were premeditated and that the brothers had committed them purely for financial gain. She doubled down on the public opinion that they were spoiled Beverly Hills rich kids, selfish, arrogant brats who only cared about themselves. The Menendez defense lawyer, Leslie Abramson, argued imperfect self-defense due to years of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse by Jose and Kitty. Judge Weisberg allowed cameras into the courtroom, and the proceedings were broadcast on Court TV daily. Court TV had only been broadcasting for around 18 months prior, and it was the first of its kind of television in the United States. This was the era of trash talk shows and unscripted reality, voyeuristic shows that centered for the perverse tastes in society. Crude, guilty pleasure television. This is the era of Geraldo, Phil Donahue, Jerry Springer, Sally Jesse Raphael, Jenny Jones, and Nikki Lake, amongst others. The Menendez trial really put Court TV on the map. Millions upon millions tuned in daily to follow the court case, and it fed the same audience who subsequently tuned in for the O.J. Simpson trial 24 months later. It turned legal proceedings and real-life crime into entertainment. Networks in the United States broadcast the trial on a split screen with NBA basketball games.
The high-stakes trials you don't want to miss. Coming soon, only on Court TV.
While being incarcerated separately in 1990 awaiting trial, Lyle wrote to Eric, where he said, quote,
Eric, we alone know the truth. We alone know the secrets of our family's past. I do not look forward, however, to broadcasting those secrets around the country.
During the trial, the brothers admitted that they had been abused psychologically, emotionally, and sexually by their parents, and it was the biggest contributing factor to them doing what they did. The defense aimed to portray the brothers as victims and not murderers. Sworn testimonies from the defensive side would go on to expose Jose Menendez as a monster who was mentally abusive and a physical tyrant towards his sons, and that he obsessively tried to mold Lyle into another version of himself. Jose, the defense alleged, viewed Eric as his throwaway son, often calling him cruel names like Howard, the F-slang word for gay people. I don't even want to repeat that word. Jose forbade tears and emotion in the house and taught his sons to stop crying when commanded. Peter Cano would testify that he witnessed his brother-in-law Jose punch his son Lyle in the chest when he was just 5 years old, simply for misbehaving. At the time he saw it, Peter was outraged, he stated. Then Jose snapped at him and said, quote, "This is my house, and I'll raise my children any way I see fit." According to Peter's wife and Jose's sister, Marta Cano, Jose wasn't the only problem in that house, however. Marta stated that she always had the impression that Kitty didn't have much affection towards the boys, and that she actually resented them for cooling down her marriage and stalling her career aspirations. The first trial, the People versus Eric and Lyle Menendez, began on July 20th, 1993. The sole reason for the almost 3 year gap between when the brothers were arrested and when the trial began was due to the state of California being unsure if it would allow the secretly recorded tapes of the brothers confessing to the murders, created by Judeline Smith, to be admissible in court or not. And that's it. Once the trial began, the brothers faced the possibility of the death penalty if convicted of first degree murder. The defense painted a picture of parents who considered their sons to be huge disappointments and embarrassed the family. Nothing, it seemed, was ever good enough for Jose and Kitty, the brothers alleged. Eric and Lyle were forced to become star athletes, and their parents would accept nothing less. Eric told how if he would lose a tennis match, Jose would berate him incessantly, and then when he won, his father would just be silent, as it was expected and not considered praiseworthy. Jose would also humiliate Kitty in public, and according to Eric and Lyle, he would beat her with a belt whilst in the privacy of their home. During the trial, both Eric and Lyle dropped further bombshells regarding their family. The mental and physical abuse allegedly suffered by the brothers was only the half of it, they said. Their father Jose, they both alleged, was also a violent and sadistic sex abuser. The brothers testified that Jose began the sexual abuse with Lyle when he was just 6 years old. Jose would tell him that what they were doing was a male bonding ritual, just like the Romans had done. Some of the sexual acts involved the insertion of a toothbrush and also the use of a shaving utensil. I'm not going to specify and spell out some of these things, they are too depraved. Lyle also confessed during questioning at the trial that he would take Eric out to the woods behind their house, sometimes at a young age, and do the same sexual acts to him, believing what his father told him about it being a positive bonding session. This progressed for several years until Lyle was around 8 years old. The following clip is an excerpt from the trial and features Lyle being questioned on the stand.
Talked about soldiers and having sex between them as a bonding mechanism.
Yes.
And did he talk about it with regard to fathers and sons?
He talked about it with regard to our relationship as being very special and our family history with the firstborn and the father.
And between the ages of 6 and 8, did your father have sexual contact with you?
Yes.
And how did it start?
It just started with, after sports practices, he would massage me. And we would have these talks, and he would show me.
Jose began molesting Eric at around the same age. Although the difference between Lila and Eric's situation was that for Eric, the abuse never stopped. In fact, the brothers alleged the sexual abuse got more and more sadistic and brutal as time went on. And it happened right up until the time period of the murders. Jose, it's alleged, would force Eric to have oral and anal sex at knife point and then beat him mercilessly afterwards. If he cried, displayed any emotion, or showed weakness, Jose would use thumbtacks, needles, rope, and other sharp objects on Eric's thighs and genitals. Whenever Jose would go into Eric's room and close the door, it was understood that they were not to be disturbed under any circumstances. Finally, the brothers alleged, Jose would also force Eric to eat lemons so that his semen would taste better. Eric had recently graduated from high school and couldn't wait to go to college. He had his sights set on UCLA. Whilst Lyle was home from university for a while, he was planning to return to Princeton by the end of the summer. Whilst the brothers confidently took to the stand and fought for their freedom, they were sure that if people knew the abuse that they went through, they would be acquitted of the murders. Their best chance of beating the case, they and the defense team thought, was to play the abuse angle and let the world know what they had lived through a lifetime of. However, the prosecution was not so convinced. Pam Bozanich, a member of the Los Angeles County District Attorney's prosecution team, maintains that the brothers fabricated the whole story of their father's alleged abuse. In a March 2024 interview with the Los Angeles Times, she stated, quote, "The facts in this case are irrefutable, except for the ones about Jose being a child molester," unquote. Paul Monez was the author of a book titled When a Child Kills, Abused Children Who Kill Their Parents. It was initially published in October of 1991. He was hired by the defense during the trial to consult with them, as he was considered to be an expert in criminal cases where, as his book title suggests, children kill their parents. Bozanich, for the last 34 years, has repeatedly stated that in the 2 years the brothers had to prep for the trial, Eric and Lyle and the defense team, including Monez, had more than enough time to fabricate, practice, and polish the child abuse angle to a point where it would be entirely believable in court at trial. Bozanich has also claimed that outside of the court during the trial period, she confronted Monez and accused him of working with the brothers to create a believable lie about the abuse. Monez, she said, refused to confirm or deny and walked away without engaging with her. Bozanich still asserts that there is no evidence of Jose being an abuser and that the brothers killed him for his fortune. Further, she says, they also killed their mother because, if they left her to live, she would inherit Jose's estate and not them, so she also had to go, in Bozanich's views. In a final attack on the Menendez defense team, Pam Bozanich has stated that before the Menendez trial, she had worked alongside Leslie Abramson, Eric's defense attorney, on several occasions, and she had a reputation, an MO if you will, for turning defense clients' cases into stories of abuse to reduce her clients' sentences. Bozanich had told her colleagues, even before the Menendez trial began, that she anticipated that Abramson would do the same here. In the nearly 3 years since Eric and Lyle's arrest, there had been no mention of Jose's abuse from them. But that was until the trial began, further adding fuel to the fire that the abuse angle had been concocted, at least in the prosecution's eyes. Eric and Lyle Menendez eventually shared during their trial how the events had played out the night of the murders. On August the 9th, 1989, the whole family was due to fly to Canada to visit Kitty's dying father. This trip was scheduled to happen after Eric had played a tennis tournament in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Eric was knocked out of the tournament after losing his first match, however, and this made Jose angry, and the family ended up going home instead. Then on August the 15th, 6 days later, Lyle and Kitty got into a heated argument about how she thought that tennis was ruining all of their lives. Kitty began waving her fists at Lyle and screaming in his face. Lyle raised his arm to defend himself as she lashed out. During the argument, Kitty grabbed Lyle's hair and tore it from the top of his head. Eric was watching all of this unfold. He had no idea that his brother Lyle was actually bald and wore a toupee. Another family secret, it seems, that they felt caused them no end of embarrassment. Lyle stormed out after this and ran to his room in the guest house to reattach his hairpiece. When he got out of the bathroom, Eric was sitting on the end of his bed crying, upset for what Lyle had just gone through, but Eric also said that he was anxious to enroll at UCLA. Not just that it was a fresh start and a new school, but because their father had told Eric that he would not be staying in the student dorms. Eric was being forced to live at home and would have to commute to the college campus daily. This was, as Jose told him, so that Kitty could supervise and support with his homework, but Eric just wanted to get out of the house. It was at this point that Eric confessed to Lyle that Jose had been sexually abusing him since the age of 8, and that it was still continuing. Lyle told him that he had suspected that it was happening. Lyle told Eric that he had actually confronted their dad some years earlier when he was a young teenager. Jose had told him, Lyle said, that it was over with Eric, and that if he said any different, then Eric was making it up. Whilst Lyle said that he wanted to believe him, he was always suspicious that it was a lie, and now he finally knew that it was, although around 8 years had now passed since the confrontation. Filled with rage at the confession from Eric, Lyle devised a plan where he would confront his father once again, this time as an adult, and will demand that Eric join him at Princeton that autumn. Jose was out of town on business at this time, but he would return late on the night of August 17th. It was then that Lyle told him that he knew everything that was going on with Eric and that it had to stop immediately. Jose, however, didn't take so well to being confronted by Lyle. He flew into a rage and screamed at Lyle that what he does to his son is none of Lyle's business. Lyle fronted up to Jose and called him a sick man and warned him that he will tell everybody about the abuse if he had to. Jose calmly responded with, quote, "We all make choices in life, son. Eric made his, you've made yours," unquote. Lyle interpreted this comment as a threat. Listeners, how do you interpret that? I'm kind of on the fence as to what Jose allegedly meant by this. Reach out, let me know your thoughts. Lyle believed that his father would now do whatever was necessary in order to protect his good name, including getting rid of his sons, which by now he had all but written off anyway. Jose stormed into Eric's room and threw him on the bed, screaming at him for revealing their secret. Eric scrambled out of the room and ran downstairs where he was confronted by Kitty. This following exchange is taken from the brother's testimony at trial. Quote, "What's the matter with you?" Kitty said. "You wouldn't understand," Eric told her. There was a smirk on her face. She seemed heavily medicated and her voice had an off quality about it. "I understand a lot more than you think. I've always known. What do you think, I'm stupid?" Kitty replied. Unquote. The following morning, Friday, August the 18th, Eric and Lyle drove to San Diego and purchased two Mossberg 12-gauge shotguns from Big Five Sporting Goods. They had shopped around in LA gun stores first, hoping to purchase a pair of handguns, but decided to purchase shotguns instead when they realized they would have to wait 2 weeks to legally obtain the handguns. The brothers also purchased birdshot ammunition with the weapons. They used a stolen driver's license in the name of Donovan Goudreau, who was one of Lyle's friends from Princeton. They completed the mandatory 4473 firearm form with Goudreau's personal information. The brothers practiced loading the shotguns on the ride back home and then hid the weapons in Eric's bedroom closet. On Saturday, August 19th, Jose and Kitty pretended like nothing had happened that week and maintained their plans for a family fishing trip aboard a boat that Jose had chartered called the Motion Picture. That sailed from Marina del Rey. Jose had lied to a colleague shortly before the trip and boasted that he was an experienced deep-sea fisherman, so he figured he should try and learn the basics to keep the lie going. Eric and Lyle tried to stall so they wouldn't have to go on the trip. They both thought it was actually a ruse by their parents, and that their mother and father were actually going to kill them while out at sea. Meanwhile, they went to another gun store and bought even more shotgun ammunition. Buckshot ammunition, in particular, after a store clerk had told them that it would, quote, do more damage. They returned to the house at around 4 p.m, assuming that their parents would have gone without them and would by now already be at sea. But unbeknownst to the brothers, shark fishing, which Jose wanted to do aboard the boat, was best carried out at sundown. So Jose and Kitty hadn't actually left yet. Perfect timing, boys, Jose said as they entered the house. So the whole family set off on their seafaring adventure. The boat owner and their fishing guide later told police that there was a very negative energy in the air during the trip. You could have cut the atmosphere with a knife. The family barely spoke with one another. He said that the two sons sat in the corner of the boat and didn't move or speak the entire time. They looked like they didn't want to be there in the slightest. When the family got home that night, Jose and Kitty went straight to bed. Eric and Lyle were uneasy and restless, however, so they snuck out of the house and drove around aimlessly, trying to decide what their next move would be. When they returned to the house, all the doors had been locked. Kitty let them back inside and was once again really annoyed that they had woken her up, even though they suspected that she had gotten up after they had snuck out to purposefully lock the doors behind them. Lyle and Eric reminded Kitty that if they were allowed to have house keys, then they wouldn't need to wake her. Kitty snapped back, quote, had you kept your mouth shut, things might have worked out in this family, unquote. This seemed like an ultimatum, a finality. Jose later pounded on Eric's bedroom door. Eric had it locked and wouldn't respond to Jose. So Jose screamed that he would have to come out in the morning, and that he would be there waiting when he does. That night Eric cradled his shotgun as he slept, he later testified. On Sunday, August 20th, the brothers decided they would stay separated all day. This was because if their parents were plotting to kill them, then it would be more likely to happen if they were together, they thought. Eric went to the Church of the Good Shepherd on Santa Monica Boulevard. Meanwhile, Eric made tentative plans with his tennis coach, Perry Berman, about meeting up at the food festival, which we spoke about in the previous episode. Around mid-afternoon, Lyle walked into the house and found Jose and Kitty watching a tennis match on television. They were quiet and didn't pay Lyle any attention. Lyle mentioned that there was a tennis camp that he wanted to attend, to which Jose replied that it didn't matter anymore and waved Lyle away. When Berman called Lyle back, Jose answered the telephone, and he lied and told him that Lyle was out shopping. Lyle overheard this conversation and became convinced that his parents were plotting to murder him and his brother, and to do it soon. When Eric arrived home at around 9:30 p.m. that night, Lyle brought him up to speed on what had happened. Eric was panicked and nervous, so they both made a beeline to the front door, where they were blocked by Kitty. Kitty was then joined by Jose. Jose demanded that Eric go upstairs and wait for him. Eric knew that his dad intended to have sex with him if he went to his room. Jose then pulled Kitty into the family TV room and closed the doors behind them. They never closed the doors to this room, the brothers thought. Lyle and Eric believed that they were about to be killed and that the time had come to take defensive action. It's them or us, they thought. They didn't have any other choice. Both brothers went outside to Eric's Ford Escort and loaded their shotguns with the buckshot ammunition. Without any hesitation, they ran inside and burst into the living room and began firing. Jose allegedly sprang to his feet shouting, "No! No! No!" He was blasted by gunfire without a pause and he flew back onto the sofa. The room was filled with deafening noise and thick clouds of gun smoke. When Lyle's gun had run out of ammunition, they both went outside to regroup and gather their composure. Eric handed Lila a single birdshot shell and they went back inside. Kitty was crying and wailing on the floor and slowly crawling, trying to escape. Lyle slowly put the barrel of the shotgun up to her cheek and fired, immediately disintegrating one third of Kitty's head. Jose and Kitty were both dead. That was it. The autopsy report stated that one of the gunshots caused, quote, explosive decapitation with evisceration of the brain and deformity of the face of Jose Menendez, unquote. That will definitely do it. Kitty's body was found laying on her right side, near to where her husband's feet were positioned. Every single bone in her face was shattered, and the rest of her body was ripped apart and mutilated by the gunshot blasts. Detectives thought that shots to the kneecaps, which Kitty had received, were made to look like a mafia execution, but not actually mafia in style. Just a weak imitation. As the gun smoke cleared, Eric and Lyle waited for the police to show up. They were certain that neighbors would have heard the whole incident. Arrest was just a matter of time, and they weren't going to run. But nobody came. They then made the split-second decision to cover up the murder in order to protect the Menendez family secret. A strange claim, I feel, given how Lyle only 2 days before was threatening Jose with exposing it. But anyway, they sprang into action to put together their cover-up. They collected all the spent shotgun shells and headed out. They thought the movie theater would make for the best alibi. So at 10:30 p.m., Eric and Lyle arrived at the AMC Multiplex in Century City. They wanted to buy tickets for a movie they'd already seen and one that had started before the killings. They figured that when questioned, they could explain what happened in the movie, proving that they had seen it, and provide tickets for a screening to show that they couldn't have been at the crime scene at the time of the crime. There was a showing of the James Bond movie, License to Kill, that began at around 8 p.m. This would be perfect, they thought, but it was sold out. The only other movie they had seen that was showing was Tim Burton's Batman. This movie was almost over, with less than 30 minutes of its runtime remaining. But the young girl who worked at the AMC counter told them that she wasn't able to sell tickets for a movie 20 minutes or more after its start time. So Eric and Lyle just bought tickets to the next screening. They, perhaps foolishly, hoped that there would be no timestamp on the tickets, which wouldn't make sense. But maybe they were desperate at this point. The tickets, however, did have timestamps, so they ended up throwing those away. The brothers then drove to a gas station to change their clothes in the bathroom. They threw their old clothes and shotgun shells in a random dumpster. Lyle then tried to get Perry Berman to join them when they returned to the house, figuring a third party with them when they discovered the bodies would strengthen their alibi. This was smart, if it had worked out. But when that plan fell through, they drove around for a while in a nervous and manic state before they eventually headed back home to put the next phase of their plan into action. This one would really test their acting chops. Eric entered the TV room screaming while Lionel called 911. We played that call in the previous episode if you need to head back and hear it again. The shotgun remained in the trunk of Eric's Ford Escort, which was parked in the garage as the police searched the rest of the house. The police never went into the garage, which was lucky for the brothers, but this was an entirely clumsy mistake to have made. Several days later, when the brothers felt that eyes were no longer on them, they disposed of the guns somewhere on Mulholland Drive. They were never recovered. Side note, and true crime fans will attest to this, but honestly, the amount of crimes committed in Los Angeles where the murder weapons are disposed of somewhere on Mulholland Drive is actually crazy. How people don't regularly stumble upon abandoned guns, knives, swords, and whatever else, I literally don't know. But I digress. Here is an excerpt of Eric's testimony at the first trial.
I just saw him go back into the den.
And you saw the doors close?
Yes.
Now, at that point, Mr. Menendez, what did you think was happening?
I thought my dad was going to come up to my room and have sex, and I thought they were going to kill us.
Jesus.
Now, when you went into the room, how soon did you start firing?
Immediately.
You said you were firing directly in front of you.
Yes.
If you're moving from the doors to the area with the TV and the coffee table, are you firing at the bookcases, which are directly in front of you?
No.
Or am I not understanding what you're saying?
I was just firing as I went into the room. I just started firing.
In what direction?
In front of me.
What was in front of you?
This seems slightly argumentative to me personally. It should be entirely obvious what was in front of Eric when he burst into the room, and the prosecution knew the answer that Eric was getting at. You can hear the frustration in Eric's voice, which is undoubtedly what the prosecutor wanted here. The account of the days leading up to the murders sets out that Eric and Lyle were, according to them, in fear for their lives. So in order to claim self-defense, this assertion was a must. At the time, the media storm, commentators, law enforcement, the prosecution, and a large chunk of the general public all felt that the brothers most likely did not think that they were about to be murdered. So the brothers were fairly isolated in these claims at this point. People just didn't believe that part of their story. That began to change, however, once their harrowing accounts of the child abuse at the hands of Jose started to emerge. At least for some. Their testimonies left most people in the courtroom, including members of the press pool, both in silence and tears. Journalist Terry Moran called it, quote, simply unforgettable, unquote. Dominic Dunn, who wrote about the case for Vanity Fair, and who regularly sided with the prosecution on the cases that he reported on, found the brothers' allegations entirely credible. Now, those of you who know who Dominic Dunn is and what happened to his daughter will understand why he was a firm supporter of the prosecution in almost every occasion. Terry Moran stated that the brothers' bad acting skills demonstrated during their description of how their lives were in danger only made their other testimonies about the abuse even more real. So, the defense presented during a trial a set of disturbing naked photos of Eric and Lyle which were taken when they were 6 and 8 years old. The photos were found in an envelope labeled Eric's 6th birthday, written in Kitty's handwriting and found in her and Jose's bedroom. These photos lent credence to the abuse story that Lyle and Eric were trying to sell. In fact, and in a further support of their testimony, in 1977, when Eric was 7 years old, he had been admitted to the ER. A doctor's record of examination detailed and explained an injury to the back of Eric's throat, which was suspected, although not proven, to be consistent with forceful oral copulation. Further, Kitty told a psychiatrist around 6 weeks prior to her death that she was hiding sick and embarrassing family secrets that could destroy her family if they were ever revealed. She also told her psychiatrist in the same session that she thought her sons were sociopaths. Marta Cano, the brother's aunt, testified that Kitty had told her that she wished her sons had never been born, that they had ruined her marriage and her career. The Menendez brothers' cousin, Diane Vandermolen, testified during the first trial that Lyle had told her in confidence about the abuse when he was around 8 years old. Diane had informed her Aunt Kitty about this revelation, but she was told that Lyle had made it up, like he regularly does with things, and that she should mind her own business. Vandermolen also testified that she saw Kitty going into the bathroom to help Lyle shower on more than one occasion. Lyle claimed that him and Kitty would often take baths together and she would make him pleasure her. In fact, Lyle said he slept in Kitty's bed with her until he was around 13 years of age. When that arrangement stopped, Lyle said, she completely turned on him and their relationship deteriorated. Menendez's cousin Andy Cano, Marta's son, testified that when Eric was 12 and Andy was 10, Eric had told him that his dad was, quote, massaging his dick and was trying to find out if these massages were normal, unquote. Eric made him pinky swear to never tell anybody. Two other cousins of the brothers, Brian and Kathleen, who spent summers with the Menendez family, said Jose would take the boys to their bedroom to play some kind of game, but he forbade the cousins from going down the hall near to their rooms or to join them. Alan Anderson, who was another relative of the Menendez brothers, testified during the first trial that Eric went from an outgoing kid with happy eyes to an introverted sad kid during all of the abuse. Do you remember Donovan Goodrow? It was his ID that the brothers used to purchase the shotguns, and he was a friend of Kyle's from Princeton University. Well, he gave an interview to reporter Robert Rand, who I mentioned in the first episode. He was the reporter who was writing the article about Jose Menendez and how he had been an immigrant that made a huge success of himself before tragedy struck. Well, during that interview, which was more than 2 years before the first trial started, Goodrow claimed that Lyle had revealed to him the sexual abuse he had endured at the hands of his father during a meal at a Chinese restaurant in May 1989. The conversation came about after Goodrow had revealed his own childhood abuse to Lyle in confidence. What makes this interview particularly interesting is that it was so long before the brothers outwardly started saying that the murders were in response to abuse at their parents' hands. Alicia Hirks, who was a neighbour of the Menendez family in Beverly Hills, stated that she attended a Menendez-hosted dinner party where Jose decided to screen a violent sex film called Peyote for the dinner guests. She said the whole evening was strange, and that video in particular was the strangest part. Hirk said that the film featured child nudity and everyone felt really awkward when Jose played the movie. The infamous LA call girl runner, Madame Sherry Woods, stated that she sent Jose many escorts while he was living and working in Los Angeles. He would usually request underage girls, she said, though she didn't clarify if she actually provided them or not. Jose's sister Terry stated that she supported her nephews during the trial, but she didn't believe any of the sex abuse claims. Now, I'm not entirely sure how that would be possible, though, because if she didn't believe the abuse claims, then the other motive would have been cold-blooded murder of their parents, her brother, to inherit their fortune. And how the hell is that more support-worthy? But there we are, I guess. Brian Anderson, Kitty's brother, called Eric and Lyle spoiled brats and didn't believe a single word that they said, even before the murders. The now infamous first trial and the subsequent media circus around it is now the stuff of legend. When you ask people about 1990s true crime and what they remember, this is often the second case that people will say, after OJ, of course. The Menendez brothers became household names. People lined up as early as 4 a.m. on trial days, hoping to get a place in the court gallery. Young women and teenagers became obsessed with the handsome brothers and behaved like they were rock stars. Leslie Abramson, in her closing statement, placed heavy emphasis on those naked photos of the young boys and hammered home at all the places where Jose used to put them. Now it was up to the two juries, because, yep, Lyle and Eric had a jury each presiding over their verdicts, to reach a decision. Meanwhile, the brothers were mercilessly roasted for what many people perceived as overacting on the stand and for their preppy rich kid fashion style. They were mocked, disbelieved, and parodied in newspapers and magazines, everything from Mad Magazine to Saturday Night Live. You know how you binge true crime documentaries on Netflix? Or read true crime books with all the sordid details? Or maybe you pop on a true crime podcast on a long drive? Well, none of that was a thing in 1990. Sure, there were shows like Unsolved Mysteries and the odd true crime magazine on sale in the supermarkets, but none of that was popular. There was also an air of shame for having an interest in it. If you bought that magazine, you might cram it down in the bag below all of your groceries. But Menendez, along with OJ, changed all that. They changed the entire landscape. They weren't trailblazers. Eric, Lyle, and OJ didn't do anything to be proud of. But their crimes came at a time when the culture was shifting and their trials were a catalyst for a true crime explosion in the cultural zeitgeist. The first trial came to an end on December 3rd, 1993, after 20 weeks and more than 100 witnesses. There were four possible convictions: first-degree murder, second-degree murder, voluntary manslaughter, or involuntary manslaughter. But after weeks of deliberations, both juries could not come to an agreement. So, in January 1994, Judge Weisberg announced that the jury was deadlocked and declared a mistrial. The defense claimed it as a sort of win for them, though it wasn't really. They would have to endure another trial, however. It would be another 18 months before Trial 2 started, though. In the following months, Eric kept himself busy by writing a huge science fiction novel. It wasn't published. Lyle, on the other hand, was busy courting a Playboy playmate named Anna Erickson. They were pen pals initially, like so many other women writing to the brothers, but romance blossomed after a prison visit. On the night of June 17, 1994, the holding cell next to Eric's had a new inhabitant, O.J. Simpson. O.J. was depressed and predisposed at the thought of losing his positive public image. What Eric didn't realize is that the man in the next cell would cement his future for him. O.J.'s eventual acquittal would embarrass the Los Angeles legal community. It came in the wake of the Rodney King and McMartin trials, which were considered huge legal failures. District Attorney Gil Garcetti was determined and focused to not allow that to happen again. The Menendez brothers' second trial began in August 1995. By this time, the Menendez family was completely broke. Every last penny was gone. Which is astonishing to me. $16 million on legal fees, taxes, real estate appraisals, and bad business dealings. The brothers' legal fees for the second trial had to be paid for by the state of California. Leslie Abramson requested to stay on as Eric's public defender, which was subsequently agreed, though she would take a steep pay cut. For the second trial, there would also be a few subtle differences from its predecessor. Judge Weisberg got rid of the cameras. This trial would not see the same media circus. The judge also limited testimonies on sexual abuse, calling them irrelevant to the case. Also, there would only be one jury. With less media exposure and no case for the defense, the brothers' fate was all but sealed. On March 20th, 1996, nearly 7 years after the crimes had taken place, and after 16 hours of jury deliberation, the jury found both Eric and Lyle guilty of murder in the first degree. Both brothers were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. In September 1996, 6 months after their incarceration, Eric and Lyle were awoken in the middle of the night and taken outside to separate vans. They were being transferred to separate prisons, so they had to accept that they would likely never see each other again. Although, there was a happy ending for them, because the brothers were finally reunited in 2018 after 22 years at the R.J. Donovan Correctional Facility in San Diego. The prison officials let them spend an hour together in a room to catch up. Which brings us up to the current day. Now, do you remember the reporter I spoke about in the previous episode and earlier in this one, Robert Rand? Well, he was the reporter who was writing an article about Jose Menendez. Well, he ended up writing a book about the murders. And due to all the time he has spent on the case over the years, he is now deemed an expert on the events. So he was hired in 2017 to be a consultant on the television series Law & Order, The Menendez Brothers. Rand spoke extensively with Marta Kano, the brother's aunt, who helped him with information and fact-checking. Kano informed him that possible evidence existed of letters between her son Andy and Eric. Somewhat incriminating letters. You see, Andy Kano sadly died from an overdose of sleeping pills in 2003, but his personal belongings still resided with his mother some 15 years later. In 2018, Robert Rand visited Marta in Florida, and within an hour they had found a handwritten letter from Eric to Andy dated December 1988. The letter states the following, quote,
Andy, I have been trying to avoid Dad. It's still happening, Andy, but it's worse for me now. Every night I stay up thinking he might come in. I need to put it out of my mind. I know what you said before, but I'm afraid you just don't know Dad like I do. He's crazy. He's warned me 100 times about telling anyone, especially Lyle. Am I a serious witness?
This letter, it is speculated, may actually qualify as new evidence in the eyes of the law. New evidence that could constitute a judge making another look at the case. I emphasize the word could. Additionally, a recent documentary series titled Menendez plus Menudo, released by the Peacock Network, makes striking new allegations. Former Menudo band member Roy Rosello spoke out about founder Edgardo Diaz sexually abusing him on a near constant basis during his time in the band. This happened, he alleges, from 1983 to 1986, and it was allegedly the worst kind of rape and assault. It went on for the entire time that Rosello was in Menudo. Diaz, the document alleges, was a complete and utter monster to the young boys that he had in his sights. There's no question. Roy Rosello received the very worst of the abuse, and eyewitnesses confirm that he was considered Edgardo's number one boy. But there was another alleged abuser that Roy talks about in the documentary series. Jose Menendez. The following clip is taken from an interview with Roy Rosello. Roy speaks entirely in Spanish, so I will provide translation for you.
Que yo iba a hacer algo grandioso para Menudo, que yo le iba a hacer un favor a Menudo y a él también. Él me dijo, "Hoy vamos a cenar en la casa del presidente, director de RCA."
I was asked by Edgardo to do something great for Menudo, that I was going to do a favor for Menudo and for him as well. He told me one day that we were going to a dinner at the house of the president of RCA.
Cuando yo entro en la limusina, yo veo Menéndez mirándome con los ojos queriendo comerme. Yo vi que él tenía otras intenciones conmigo. Mis pies temblaron. Yo estaba muy nervioso.
When I got in the limousine, I saw Menendez looking at me, as if he wanted to devour me. I immediately saw that he had other intentions for me. My feet trembled. I was very nervous.
Cuando llegué a la casa de los Menéndez, ellos tenían dos hijos. Los vi a los dos. Uno estaba sentado bien en el pasillo de la entrada, con una cara tan triste. Ni me saludó. Yo sentí el clima cuando yo entré en esa casa, sentí el clima de abusos. Yo sentí un clima tan pesado, tan cargado, tan negativo en esa casa, que yo me sentí mal.
When I arrived for dinner at the Menendez house, they had two sons. I saw them both. One was sitting at the entrance hallway with such a sad look on his face. He didn't even say hello. I felt a dark negative vibe in that house. It was the energy of abuse, and it was such a heavy, negative atmosphere at home that it made me feel sick.
Yo me senté en la mesa del comedor. Comenzaron a hablar. They was talking, Edgardo and Menendez. Y al momento me ofrecieron una copa de vino. Yo tenía 13 años. Edgardo no acostumbraba a servir bebidas alcohólicas. También hay ese punto. José Menéndez me dijo, toma este vino. Es un vino carísimo. Y tómate toda la taza. Después que yo me la tomé, yo me comencé a sentir un cansancio, un peso. Yo no podía más moverme. A partir de ese momento, yo solamente veía cosas como que desenfocadas.
I sat down at the table of the dining room. They started to talk. There was talking. Edgardo and Menendez. And they offered me a glass of wine. I was 13 years old. Edgardo didn't normally serve alcoholic beverages. Jose Menendez told me, drink this wine. It's very expensive wine, so finish it all. After I finished the glass of wine, I started to feel tired and heavy. I couldn't move anymore. From that point on, everything looked blurry.
Alguien me empujó, alguien me cargó, alguien trying to push me. Y yo caminé un pasillo bien largo. y había un cuarto. Yo no podía reaccionar porque eso me estaba tomando cuenta de mi cuerpo. Me drogaron. Y después de eso, yo amanecí en el hotel. ¿Cómo yo llegué al hotel? Yo no sé. Pero cuando yo fui al baño, I was bleeding. Y yo estuve una semana con un dolor terrible. Con un dolor que no podía más. No me podía ni mover. Yo me acuerdo que yo tenía que simular que yo no estaba con dolor, pero el dolor estaba tomando cuenta de mi vida, que era un dolor terrible. Y sangré muchísimo.
Someone pushed me. Someone carried me. Someone tried to push me. I walked down a very long hallway. There was a room, but I couldn't react because I had no control over my body. They had drugged me. After that, I woke up in the hotel. I have no idea how I got to the hotel. But when I went to use the bathroom, I was bleeding. I was in terrible pain for a week. I could barely stand the pain. I couldn't even move. I had to pretend that I wasn't in pain, but the pain was unbearable. I was in terrible pain, and I bled a lot. Menudo signed with RCA Records, who Jose was a senior executive, for a huge $30 million record deal. The night that they signed the deal, Rosello went to the Menendez house for dinner. And while there, he met Eric and Lyle, as he states in his statement. Eric actually confirms in the documentary that he remembers meeting Roy that night. Rosello then goes on to allege that Jose drugged him and then raped him. Mark Garagos, a lawyer who has represented Michael Jackson, O.J. Simpson, and Winona Ryder in the past, filed a petition on May 3, 2023. Garagos has requested that the court look at the case again and vacate the convictions based on new evidence. Attorneys argue that the newfound letters and Rosello's statements should constitute a review of the case. Essentially, under the basis that these are two pieces of evidence that prove Jose Menendez was an abuser, which in theory should validate Eric and Lyle's reasoning and motives for committing the murders out of self-defense and not cold-blooded first-degree murder. These revelations has constituted the Menendez brothers to once again gain a large following on social media, particularly TikTok, mostly teenage and young girls who think the men should be released as they were victims and not killers. But what do you think? Do you agree with this teenage TikTok army of Generation Z who think they should be free men? Or do you think that regardless of their reasoning, they still murdered two people and vigilante justice should not be acceptable? As always, I would love to hear from you and hear your thoughts. Finally, I'll leave you tonight with this final comment. When Eric originally confessed to the crimes to his therapist, Dr. Oziel, Eric told the doctor that him and his brother Lyle had, quote, committed the perfect crime, and that their father would be really proud of them.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.